Let's have the Judiciary Committee come to order. It is 1:35 in the afternoon of Monday, February 8th, 2010. We have a quorum here to conduct business. Senator Egan is here, Senator Coghill, myself, Senator French. We've got several bills up on the docket today, but to let the public know, one bill is going to be moved to Friday, SJR 21, the constitutional amendment to increase the number of legislators. The sponsor has asked that we move that bill, and we've acceded to his request, so that will not be heard today. It will be heard Friday instead. I know, Senator Coghill, you're not going to be here then, but if you'd like to put on the record some of your thoughts about that idea, we'd be happy to hear them, at least make them part of the record.
Not prepared at this point, Mr. Chairman. So what I might do is I might type up something and just have it for the committee.
Fair enough.
But I do have some reservations.
Excellent. I just want to make sure you had a full opportunity to speak on the bill. We do have one bill previously heard while we're getting ready and letting some other members join us. SB 60 was heard last week. We heard from the bill sponsor. We heard from Mr. Shaftel, a practitioner in the area. We took public testimony. The bill is back before us. Do any members have any amendments or suggestions about changing the bill while we have it in our possession? Don't hear or see any. With that, I think we're ready for a motion. Senator Egan.
Mr. Chair, I move that committee substitute for Senate Bill 60 related to the Uniform Probate Code be moved from committee on the next or onto the next committee referral with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill is moved from committee. We'll take a short at ease to do the paperwork. We're back on the record, and next up on the docket is SB 210. I see the prime sponsor here, and his trusty aide. Please come forward. Welcome. Nice to have you back with the Judiciary Committee. Senator Huggins, Josh, please put yourselves on the record, and you can take it away.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Charlie Huggins, Senate District H, and
Josh Temple, staff to Senator Huggins in the Veterans Caucus.
Please proceed.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, sitting to my left here, I always see Josh as he's dressed in red as a Marine. Today he has his patriotic tie on, which happened to be a Christmas present from some guy sitting right to his right. So appropriate that he's wearing that today. But Senate Bill 210, number one, I appreciate this coming before the committee, and this is part sort of a national effort. There's a young man by the name of Mark Sullivan, who we'll hear from later on, from North Carolina, as I recall, a family attorney that has got this legislation passed in multiple states at this point in time. And I will just characterize as the effort, as we see it, being a modernization of how we address soldiers and families in the deployment. And just a couple things that I would ask you to bear in mind. there's a lot of stress in the communities that have military in them. There's a lot of stress on military families, and the suicide rate, quite frankly, is a historical high. And all those are difficult things. And a part of that is the domestic strife piece, I'll call it, between husbands and wives and girlfriends and all those sorts of things. And one of the things that's changed dramatically since a lot of this legislation was put into place, there's a lot of female service members. So classically, we quite often think of the deployed person being a male. Quite often, it's the mother, if you will. Now, here's the real catcher. Is that sometimes it's mother and father that are deployed. So there's a lot to be looked at as far as the modernization piece of what we do. And this, I would just ask you to look at this in the sense that it's a good faith effort to see how we can help young people, specifically those kids that it comes to bear on and what happens to them in the tug of wars. And there's an electronic element here of how you communicate if you're in Afghanistan, and there's a process of communications going on, a hearing or whatever back here in Alaska or some other place, but in this case, Alaska. And then I guess the other part finally that is important for us to recognize is that technically we Alaska are an overseas tour of duty for many soldiers and airmen and Marines just by the way things are written. And we're a long ways away from places like Georgia and Florida and that whole piece of how you bring families back together and the stresses that keep them apart. And some of those elements are in here. And just even to the point of definition of what a military absence is, whether it's a deployment, whether it's a long-term tour of duty or short-term tour of duty or other sorts of things. And you know, the other one we know that comes to bear is the permanent fund dividend, which cash and cash flow in families is often a challenge for young families, if you will. And I think by and large we're talking about young families, but here's the other one I would ask you to think about for a moment is the most that I've heard a service member having been deployed was 7 times, and that was last Christmas, and I was standing in a line at the post office and out in Matsu Valley. And the young man ahead of me, who was a sergeant first class, fixing to make first sergeant, told me about the 7, and he said, and I'm also getting a divorce. And on and on and on. So in any event, I think there are some elements here that certainly are wise of us to take a look at. You have some well-qualified people to sort through them, and we bring it before you. And Josh is the expert here, and I will let him be the expert, and I'll just stand by if you have questions.
Thank you, Senator Huggins. Questions for the bill's sponsor? I don't see any. Mr. Temple, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, as Senator Huggins was saying, during the past decade, our military services have been very stressed, and our military families have been very stressed. Frequently, service members are in Iraq and Afghanistan, they're deployed, they're divorced, and they're single parents. It's causing them to fight battles on two fronts, really, the one overseas and the one back home when they have to do a child custody battle with their ex-spouse. Now, that's what we're trying to address in this statute, SB 210. We are trying to give the courts a clear directive on how to deal with military deployments. Before I go into this too much, I want to say that last year in Congress, they took this matter up and they said that this is not a federal issue. This is something that will conflict with state child custody laws. This is something that should be dealt with on the state level. Okay. Basically, it's our responsibility to do something about this. We went before the Alaska Bar Association, their family law section, and got input from them. We went before the National Guard attorneys, the JAG attorneys, and got their input. We also got input from family law attorneys within the state who deal with military service members. So what the statute includes is, one, includes the definition of what a military absence is, deployment. We also included language that says if Sergeant Jane on Fort Richardson is in a child custody battle, the fact that she might get deployed at some point can't be held against her in the custody case. Can't say you may be deployed in the future. We aren't going to have you have custody of your child. We went on to say that if she does get deployed, she can take her deployment orders down to the courthouse and say, I need an expedited hearing because I'm getting deployed next month. And in that expedited hearing, she can get a temporary custody order put in place for the duration of the deployment. One of the stipulations in that order is that she can designate some visitation rights, say 1 weekend a month to grandma or grandpa, which will enable her child to end up having some kind of connection with her during the deployment. Now, if for some reason there has to be an emergency hearing that's in the best interest of the child, well, she's deployed, well, Sergeant Jane is deployed, then we've included language in here that allows her to be part of that trial through something like Skype, a video system, which is the courts are currently starting to do. Doug Wolver can talk about that, but it's something that the family law attorneys at the Bar Association wanted to see a lot more of. They're really supportive of this element of it. And then next, we included language that said that when Sergeant Jane gets back from her deployment, if she goes into the courthouse and says, I'm back and I'm ready to take custody of my child again, within 10 days, she gets custody back, or it goes back to whatever order was in place prior to deployment, so custody or visitation or whatever she had prior. Now, with all that said, we understand that people have personal issues. Sometimes Sergeant Jane perhaps has some domestic violence issues against her. She may have alcohol. People have different issues. So we've included very, very clear language in this document that states that there is nothing here that restricts the courts from doing what is in the best interest of the child. We also understand that service members can come back from a deployment a little bit different than they left, both physically or mentally. So we include language that says that if the non-deploying spouse files a motion for immediate and irreparable harm to the child, that there will be a hearing taken. So the child's best interests are taken into account, and this bill is all about the child's best interests. So in recognizing that the federal government should not legislate this statute, that Alaska has many, many servicemen, that their deployments are continuing to increase, and that the divorce rate inside the military is also increasing, it's our responsibility here today to address this. And then, in conclusion, I've got a 3-minute video on CBS that talks about this issue. Mr. Chairman, if I can have permission to play that.
Just 1 second. Let me, I've neglected my chairman's duties. Senator McGuire joined us some long time ago, and I neglected to point that out. Thank you, Senator McGuire. And let me see if there's any questions from members of the committee before we go to the video. Don't see any. Please proceed. Thank you.
It's been about 2 months since I've seen him. It's been a year since he's lived with me.
She and her ex-husband are battling over custody of their 14-year-old son, John. Vincent, in accordance with the mandated family care plan, temporarily gave her ex-husband custody before being deployed last December. Return home once she did.
I had gotten an email from my son's father that says, you need to get a lawyer. I'm not sending your son back to you.
Her ex-husband did not want to talk to CBS News, but has argued in court it's in their son's best interest to stay with him in Florida for stability.
I feel that I'm being put in the same category as an unfit mother.
Lieutenant Colonel Benson's case isn't unique. CBS News has identified 30 similar cases over the last 2 years, and many of them, single military parents have either lost all custody rights or have had them significantly altered, increasing calls for Congress to step in.
Well, this would give them...
Representative Michael Turner has proposed a bill that would set federal standards on custody rights for service members.
It is unbelievable the number of family court judges across this country who will willingly use a service member's time away in serving their country in Iraq and Afghanistan to take custody away from them.
A CBS News analysis of custody laws has found only 5 states that automatically return children after deployment. 5 more prohibit deployment from being used in court. 14 others have weaker protections, and the rest provide U.S. service members with no additional protections. The Department of Defense has successfully fought the bill since its introduction in 2007, arguing that states are better equipped to handle custody issues. Declining an on-camera interview, the Pentagon issued this statement, saying, "We strongly believe the federal legislation in this area of the law, which has historically and almost exclusively been handled by states, would be counterproductive."
And that's my son.
A change in the law won't come soon enough for Lieutenant Colonel Benson. A judge in Florida has jurisdiction over her case. A state that has limited protection for service members. She's expected to rule next week.
We're asked to drop everything to go to combat. Is it too much to ask that we have protection for when we come back to get our children back? That kind of hit me. That
back to the homes of military parents, now dealing with another consequence of America's two wars. Michelle Miller, CBS News, Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
Good presentation. Any other questions for the bill sponsor or Mr. Temple while we've got them here? We do have folks signed up to testify. Thank you. If you'd stand by, maybe some questions will come up in the near-term future. Let's turn now to the off-nets, where we have Mark Sullivan. Mark Sullivan, if you're there and you can hear me, go ahead and tell us your name and who you're affiliated with, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Yes, my name is Mark Sullivan. I'm a member of the Military Committee of the Family Law Section of the American Bar Association. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, we sure can, sir. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm a family law attorney practicing in Raleigh, North Carolina, and I'm a retired JAG colonel, Army Reserve. I'm also the author of the Military Divorce Handbook. I've been working with many states concerning their statutes, and I was just appointed to the committee of the Uniform State Law Commission on military custody and visitation laws. I wrote our own statute here in North Carolina, and I'm the true outsider. I'm a fly on the wall. I'm here to report on your proposed legislation, which I have just read over, Senate Bill 210, version N, along with the comments of Senator Huggins. And I wanted to tell you, I'm very impressed. Your proposed statute runs circles around the one that I wrote for North Carolina. There's a certain amount of similarity between the two. Both of them say that you may not consider a parent's deployment in determining the best interest of the child on a hearing for a change of custody. Both of them grant delegated visitation rights to a family member. They allow for expedited hearings, electronic participation, and the return of the child within 10 days after the deployed parent is able to resume custody. However, yours is even better than the one we have on the books here in North Carolina and goes several steps beyond what we've passed. By not allowing the absence because of deployment to be used by a parent as a waiver of rights to be with the child unless there's an express waiver to that effect. Your statute also requires the deployed, non-deployed parent to make the child available to the service member during periods of leave from deployment. It requires the non-deployed parent to facilitate contact between the service member and the child. It mandates the deployed parent give timely information to the non-deployed parent about the leave schedule. And it also requires immediate notification by the non-deployed parent of any change in address or contact information. Simply put, I am amazed at how much better your bill is than our statute. I applaud your hard work in drafting this excellent piece of proposed legislation, and I will be pointing to Alaska as the leading state in protecting children of service members, as well as their parents, when I meet in April with the Uniform Law Commissioners to talk about what the states are doing and how we can write up a model law. When we do that, we're going to use Alaska as the example. I hope that I can assist you in any way possible to facilitate this passage. And I thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk with you as an outsider and give you my own perspective on how well this bill fits the needs of our mothers and fathers in uniform.
Mr. Sullivan, thank you for bringing your expertise to our committee. Any questions for Mr. Sullivan? Senator Coghill.
Thank you. One of the things that I noticed in this bill that just came to mind, and maybe you've dealt with it, is when you have, for example, a custody of a deployed person the youngster is in the visitation rights of another. Is there a power of attorney issue? Is that something that the courts require, notwithstanding the statute?
The power of attorney is always going to be in place if it is the military custodian who is deployed, leaving the child with the non-military parent. The power of attorney is part of what is called the family care plan. Done properly, the family care plan requires our hypothetical Sergeant Jane Doe, upon deployment, to leave a power of attorney for education, health care, and all other issues with the person she designates in her family care plan to take over the child during her absence. That is part of military regulations.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions from Mr. Sullivan? I don't hear or see any. Again, thank you, sir, for taking the time to testify for our committee this afternoon.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Mark Sanssouci. If I'm saying your name correctly, sir, if you're on the line, go ahead and introduce yourself, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair French and members of the committee. On behalf of the Department of Defense, my name is Mark Sanssouci. I'm the regional liaison for the Northwest for the Department of Defense State Liaison Office, operating under the direction of the Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness and the Deputy Undersecretary for Military Community and Family Policy. Our mission is to be a resource to state policymakers as they work to address quality of life issues for military families. First, though, I'd like to thank you all for voting last year for the Interstate Compact in Education for Military School Children, and especially Senator Coghill, who prime sponsored. You joined 26 other states in providing protection for our military kids who move with their families, and for that we are extremely grateful. Now, Senator Huggins, and thank you for sponsoring, and Josh Temple eloquently have already made the case. In today's environment where the divorce rate among military unfortunately continues to climb, divorced service members have custody of or visitation rights with children whose other parent is not the service member's current spouse. Many of these service members who are deployed away from their family find that states do not consider the unique aspects of military service when making custody decisions. These absences due to military service can undermine and disrupt existing arrangements, creating stress on parents and children. Without contact from their children, deployed members are frequently devastated, and it degrades their ability to focus on their mission, and that is what we need. This inequity caused such stress that this year, this issue became one of the top 10 key issues affecting military families for the Department of Defense State Liaison Office to focus on in the states. Although the Department of Defense believes the welfare of the child is paramount, it also believes the demands of military service should not abrogate the parent's rights. The department, like the American Bar Association, thinks the states, not the federal government, are in the best position to balance such equities and believes there are several protections states could enact which would serve both the parents' rights and the welfare of the children. As Mark Sullivan has just pointed out, the policy put forth in the language of SB 210 superbly addresses all the areas of concern related to military members in child custody. It prevents the courts from considering absences due to deployment as the sole basis when making custody and visitation decisions. It allows for expedited hearings or the use of electronic communication so that deployment does not prevent a service member from participating in court hearings. It supports the reinstatement of the custody order after the service member returns from deployment and allows for the delegation of visitation rights and visitation during periods of leave, ensuring a continued bond with their children and the military member. With the substantially increased and continual activity of our armed forces around the world today, many states are recognizing the need for statutes which protect the rights of both service members and their children. At present, 32 states have passed laws that address some aspect of the difficulties facing parents who temporarily must give up custody of their children or who must forego visitation when called to take up the burdens of the nation. We wish to thank Senator Huggins for sponsoring and thank you for the opportunity to submit testimony and look forward to Alaska's leadership in adopting these vital protections for our service members. I stand by to take any questions and will be happy to try and answer them or get you the information you need. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Let me see if there's any questions for Mr. Sanssouci. Senator Egan, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sanssouci, we just watched a CBS report and they were talking about legislation and in different states, and they were classifying some of this legislation is strong or weak or nil. How would you classify this proposed legislation?
As Mark Sullivan, who we even defer as the expert on this, pointed out, this one is, as Mark Sullivan pointed out, this one is superb. The elements, the provisions that we look for are the ones that I mentioned about preventing courts from considering absences due to deployment as a sole basis, allowing for expedited hearings, electronic communication, supporting reinstatement of the order when the member returns from deployment, and allowing for delegation. Those are essentially the five provisions that we were looking for. In some states, some bills only have two of them. Matter of fact, in Hawaii last week, the bill they're considering only has a couple of those provisions. And so there are different states that grab on to different provisions, but this one covers it all. And it is, as Mark Sullivan points out, is excellent.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Coghill has a question.
Thank you. And for the Department of Defense, one of the issues that's going to rise in my mind is if we put this in law in the state, that puts another burden pretty much for family accommodation within the military. So can you help us understand, for example, on if somebody is given custody during the time of deployment, what the Department of Defense is going to do to accommodate the deployed person? I'm thinking mostly of communication, travel accommodations, things like that.
I would speculate that certainly it will help provide the member with the electronic capabilities that person needs, recognizing that the state law is what will govern, and so the Department of Defense and the respective military service will no doubt, has already done in the past, work with members who have had court issues where the states have required them to comply. Otherwise, I would just be speculating, Senator Coghill, how the department will respond. With 32 states having some aspects of this, I know that a lot of this is already going on. I don't know if that completely answers your question. I think that might be the best I can do.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, just one more. With those that might come back either for short term between deployments, or those who are maybe back in the States for temporary duty, or coming back on leave, a lot of those are going to, because of the nature of the marriage issue, may very well be housed on the post or base. Is there issues that have already been resolved with that regard?
I'm not aware of issues that have come up, or issues in terms of, you mean accommodating maybe the family that no longer has a military ID card to stay on a post or on a base, sir? Is that what you're referring to, maybe? Or
that could be one of the circumstances, Mr. Chairman. It could be very well be that because of the family not being together anymore, that the military ID might go. Of course, I would imagine under joint custody, a youngster would probably retain a military ID. But I was thinking more particularly of if somebody is on a post or base in billeting, and we are requiring hearing and custody issues, that they're not going to have to rent a motel off post or base to accommodate some of those things.
Through the chair, Senator, I would agree with you there. I think that would be something that would be of paramount concern. I also think that the family member, the children certainly still have their military identification, and so if it's a question of having the child be accommodated on post, and they even still have benefits, the BX and all of those things, then I imagine that would still occur. Again, if there's something else specifically, I would be glad to provide the answer. I'm a little hesitant to speculate on exactly each circumstance.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's just that we're putting requirements that the court must do certain things, and I want to make sure that we don't have them standing outside a gate somewhere in the cold weather trying to visit each other.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, I can't.
Go ahead.
The language on page 2, line 13, says the non-deploying parent make the child reasonably available for visitation to the deployed parent when the deployed parent is on leave if the visits are in the child's best interest. That bill says making it reasonably available, so there isn't a mandatory reasoning says the child has to stay with the deployed parent, and also says within the child's best interests.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I understood their responsibility. I was just looking for Department of Defense saying that it wasn't going to be a big problem if you accommodate parents who get to visit their young child while on leave or something like that on a post. Just looking for those accommodations. Thank you.
Thanks.
Further questions from Mr. Sansusi while we have him on the line? I don't see any. Again, thank you, sir, for testifying this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next up is Christine Pate. If you're there, go ahead and give us your name and affiliation, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony. Christine Pate, can you hear me? Ms. Pate?
Yes, sorry about that. I had my mute button on also.
Quite okay. Go ahead. We can hear you fine. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. My name is Christine Pate. I am a supervising an attorney with the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I run a statewide legal program for victims of domestic violence and sexual assault and been doing so a little over 10 years. I've been practicing family law in the state of Alaska for about 15 years. And I want to first take the time just to thank Senator Huggins for working to help deployed parents and let him know that the network supports his efforts to help our men and women who are serving our country to maintain close contacts with their children. I've been working with his office on this bill a little bit. We had some initial safety concerns about some of the language for as it might apply in cases of domestic violence, and many of those concerns have been fixed, but we have a few more issues that I'm a little unsure of how the language reads right now, how it would work in practice, and just wanted to mention those on the record. The first issue, I guess, is the issue of expedited hearings at both the initial custody phase and in the modification phase. I guess I'm looking at line D of page 2, at line 6, and then on page 4 at line 5. There already are processes in place for expedited hearings. I understand that deployed parents may at times have situations where they are being deployed immediately and there's no time to go through a full process of waiting for a hearing in our Alaska courts. My concern, however, though, is when a parent does have the time, because some parents know they're going to be deployed with some degree of certainty in the future, that there could be abuse of this process when there's cases of domestic violence. And I guess I just speak from experience seeing people scrambling to find attorneys. We know that in our courts up to 80% of people are going through family law proceedings pro se, meaning they don't have attorney assistance. We have more demand in our program than we can find attorneys for. And I'm just concerned that people will be, have expedited hearings happening when someone is using this in an abusive tactic in litigation, which we know that at times abusers do this. My second area of some, I guess, just clarification is I appreciate that the senator and his staff worked with us to get some language in there to ensure that our laws protecting victims of domestic violence and sexual assault and custody cases is clearly linked to this statute. It's not clear to me, although I think the legislation means to do it, it's just I don't think the language is clear, that if I am a parent who is delegating my rights to another family member, whether the rebuttable presumption found in our custody law would apply not only to me, but also to that family member. And I guess our concern might be that the deployed parent might be a fine parent. There may not be any concerns about domestic violence there, but there may be a history of domestic violence with the parent to whom they are seeking to delegate their custodial rights to. And I would just want the language clear that it would apply to both of those people as you know, potential custodians of children. And just the last comment would be, I think it is important for parents always to, update other parents about address information and changes of location, and certainly that's important when there's, a deployed parent who has very limited contact It would be helpful for victims of domestic violence if there was a clause in there after the line talking about providing address information that, you know, assuming that there are no safety concerns for a parent or a child. We hope we can make these changes with the staff and appreciate the work on the bill and look forward to working further on it. Thank you.
Ms. Pate, thank you for your comments. Any questions for Ms. Pate while we have her on the line? I don't hear or see any. Again, thank you for taking the time to testify this afternoon.
Thanks.
Finally, we have Alan Bailey from Anchorage, a practitioner in this area. Mr. Bailey, can you hear me?
I can, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee. Please put yourself on the record. We'd be happy to hear your thoughts on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This is Alan Bailey. I am a family lawyer in Anchorage. I've been in practice for 36 years, 26 of those as a family lawyer, virtually continuously handling family law cases for service members from Elmendorf and Fort Richardson, now known as Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. I am currently the chair of the custody committee, child custody committee of the ABA Family Law Section. I'm a former member of the American Bar Association's Commission on Domestic Violence, and I'm a member of the Anchorage DV Caucus. I am very pleased. I've worked with Josh quite a bit on this bill, expressing the concerns of the domestic violence community and family lawyers whom I know, and based on my own experience, the drafters of this legislation have done an outstanding job of incorporating wording that makes sure that the courts consider the domestic violence issues along with the best interest of children, which are the two most important things that the judge is going to be considering in these requests. I've discussed the terms that are needed and not needed with my friend Mark Sullivan for probably the last 4 years at meetings of the ABA Family Law Section. I was planning to draft a bill similar to this last winter, but I became very ill and was unable to do that. I'm very pleased that Senator Huggins and his staff have taken it upon themselves to accomplish this. I at one time thought, well, the North Carolina bill is much briefer and the wording is more eloquent and it accomplishes the same thing in a lot less space. I have since studied this legislation and find it's going to be a lot easier to enforce than the bill in North Carolina because of its more specific terms. Eloquence and expression of goals is a great thing, but when I'm in court and I'm arguing to a judge how much notice should be given to the other parent when I seek an expedited hearing for my client, I want those numbers in the bill. This bill does something that unfortunately some members of the judiciary in Alaska no longer talk about. I'm reminded of a time before Judge Karen Hunt when she told me that when I asked about my client's prospective PCS to a new Air Force base from Elmendorf, if that was going to interfere with the court's, with the decision in the court. And she said, I will never hold a service member's decision to serve his country against him in this court. The incorporation of a broader amount of, or a broader number of means of electronic communication is important in my experience, because when I'm in court and my client is present and the other side is appearing by telephone, I am have observed time after time that my client is much more credible because he or she is there in the courtroom and the judge can watch my client testify and gain an appreciation of his or her honesty and qualities. The incorporation of internet-based video testimony is very important in reducing the advantage of a person who's there in the courtroom over a person who's perhaps in Afghanistan or Iraq, as some of my clients have been. As a longtime family lawyer, I recommend the passage of this legislation. One of the things that, or two of the things that I have been appreciative for in how this bill evolved was there was some wording initially in earlier versions that might have conflicted with some state and national legislation affecting child custody, and that problem has been eliminated in this version of the bill. That's draft N as in Nancy. Thank you.
Mr. Bailey, thank you. I think Senator Wilikowski has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for being late. I had another bill hearing.
And I should recognize that Senator Wilikowski has been here from some 5 minutes or so.
Yeah. And I apologize, I missed this point, but I'm just curious how courts look at, I guess I'm curious how courts look at it now and how they would look at it under this bill for a parent that was, let's say, deployed to a war zone. Let's say a father had custody of his child, he's deployed to Afghanistan, Iraq. How do the courts look at that now? I mean, could the parent bring the child with him or her, and how would that change under this bill?
Mr. Bailey, do you want to take a stab at that?
Mr. Chairman, I will. Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilikowski, I think we have 15 Superior Court judges in Anchorage, 10 of whom are handling civil cases, and there's almost an infinite number of possible ways that these matters could be handled. There are some judges who are quite sympathetic and empathetic and understanding about military life and would have handled matters the same before this legislation as they will after. Unfortunately, some of the younger members of the judiciary and others who have not lived in and around military bases most of their lives or much of their lives would not be so understanding. This bill will require, or rather prohibit, the judge from considering the deployment of the parent in determining what's happening. So there will be a temporary order for the non-custodial parent in your hypothetical to have custody of the child during the deployment, and the deploying parent can delegate members of his family who have a close relationship to the child to spend time with the child while the parent is deployed. As soon as the deployment ends, the order will revert unless someone takes an action to bring the child's safety to issue. Is that helpful?
If I could just follow up, Mr.
Chair. Yes.
And I mean, my vague recollection of family law is that the ultimate touchstone is what's in the best interest of the child. Is that pretty much still the standard today?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilikowski, yes, that is the touchstone, although I tell my clients it's the guiding star that the court uses, although the enactment of the presumption in 2524-150G and resolutions adopted by interdisciplinary groups in the past few years are bringing the safety of the child to a much stronger position in that hierarchy of concerns.
if I go ahead. Again, Mr. Chair, thank you. Do courts typically order children to go along with their parents when they're deployed to, I mean, do they ever?
Oh, that part of the question, I wasn't sure I understood that question, Senator Welikowski. No, I have never heard of a court ordering that unless the deployment was to a technically overseas base such as Alaska.
And then
it appears, at least to some in the military, that Alaska is still a territory.
And I guess just to play devil's advocate on this, if under the language of Section 1A, it appears that if someone were requesting to take to have custody to bring their child to Iraq, Afghanistan, the court couldn't say no because it's a war zone. That would concern me a little bit. Is that the way you read this, or am I just is that not am I misreading that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Welikowski, my understanding of how these things work is the service member who has custody has to execute a family care plan and a power of attorney to whomever he designates, presumably the former spouse, to care for the child if he is deployed. I don't believe parents are permitted to take their children along on deployments, or anywhere that children might be endangered.
Okay, that's very helpful. And I guess I should just add that.
Sure.
That's sort of, I'm just looking at the language here. It says, except as provided in this section, a parent's temporary duty, mobilization, or deployment may not be a factor. So, I mean, I guess we're taking away the court. If someone said, I want to bring my child into another country, pick a country, the court can no longer look at that, even if it is a war zone. Now, I guess the military may have something else to say, but am I reading this incorrectly here?
Maybe I can just jump in. I mean, my understanding was the point of the bill was to not penalize a deployed parent for their deployment. I didn't get the thrust of the bill's sponsor to be to allow a child to go along with a soldier deployed across the globe. Mr. Temple.
Mr. Chairman, one, I'd like to call Jean Michelle up to comment on a few of these.
Okay.
She's been
one of the drafters. Yep.
Drafting.
We know Ms. Michelle. We're happy to see her.
But
welcome.
Two, I'd like to say that we've included very good language in here that says that can't be done if it's not in the child's best interests, and bring that child into a war zone is definitely not in the child's best interests. And I've never heard an occasion in which a commander would allow his troops to bring a child into a war zone.
Mr. Temple, thank you. Ms. Michelle, welcome.
And Senator Welikowski, go ahead. I imagine that would be the case either, but just the way that it's written, it's pretty clear. You can't look at the deployment may not be a factor in the court's decision. So anyway, I'll just happy to hear what you have to say.
Welcome.
Thank you. Jean Michelle with Legal Services. I'm the drafting attorney on this bill. I have to admit I hadn't construed that language that broadly in my own mind, but the intention, and if it's not clear, we can certainly modify it, but the intention is not to completely override all the other provisions that govern custody and visitation orders in the state, but to, as Senator French mentioned, not penalize a parent for being under deployment or in A of that section or move to an active military status. There's still laws in the state and in every state that govern moving a child out of the home jurisdiction. That still applies. And the best interest of the child is clearly stated throughout sections 1 and 2. So I would be very surprised if a court misconstrued that provision to require or even allow a child to be deployed with the parent. The other military side of that is that the deployment orders specify whether it's with a family or without a family, and certainly state law can't override that order. So I don't think that provision could be misconstrued in that way.
I think the senator raises a good point. It may be something we just sort of pull back and ponder for a day or so to make sure we don't inadvertently, you know, raise questions in judges' minds that don't need to be raised.
We could go back to the sole factor in making a decision.
Sure. And Ms. Michelle, you heard Ms. Pate testify. One of the points I made note of was on page 2, line 6. Go to page 4, line 5. It was about expedited hearings for parents either being deployed or subject to deployment. And I wonder how long, or maybe Mr. Temple, you know, how long are you subject to deployment? How long does that status sort of attach to a service member? Are you always subject to deployment? How would a non-military person analyze that, or a judge?
Mr. Chairman, a subject to deployment means you've received notification that you're going to deploy. Frequently, you'll receive your orders for deployment. Let's say today's date, and you're going to deploy in a month. So you are not yet deployed. You'll be possibly out of state in a month where you can't do anything about your custody arrangement. However, you have been notified that you'll be deployed.
And that's very helpful, and that's where I think we may just want to either make sure we define that, because as a non-military person, I would think that all military people are subject to deployment. You know, at some point they can get an order that sends them overseas, and so that might just be an area where confusion arises, where it's clear to you what it means, but it's not clear to me or a non-military judge looking at that. So that's just, Ms. Michelle, go ahead.
Senator French, I believe that issue is dealt with in the definition of deployment or deployed.
And I think my staffer just pointed that out to me as well. Thank you.
Okay.
Other questions for Ms. Michelle or Mr. Temple while we have them? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else online who'd like to testify about SB 210? Anyone else in the room would like to testify?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
There is one question I would like to ask. Please. And since we have Ms. Michelle here, and one of the things that was said in your introduction of the bill was that upon return of deployment, there could be another hearing determining the fitness of or the status of the parent who was deployed and had guardianship. Where do I find that in here? Help me.
Senator French,
yes.
Through the chair. Senator Coghill, I think you're referring to page 3, lines 26 through 29, and that addresses the resumption or reinstatement of the existing order if it's temporarily modified under Section 2 of the bill.
Okay. The question that I had, Mr. Chairman, was it is true that somebody coming back from a deployment, especially if it's a war zone deployment, could have a huge impact on both emotional stability, could be traumatic brain injury like one of our panelists here always talks about. But it is also true that the person who stayed as the non-deployed could equally have those issues, and are they as well subject to the reevaluation? That was kind of my trying to figure. I couldn't see the language, and I was trying to find out if it worked both ways. That's all.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, there are actually two. I'm just reviewing this page, starting at page 3, line 20, and extending through line 29, and the answer is yes, but the non-deployed parent has the burden of proof if there's for just resumption or against resumption of the original order.
Okay, all right. so it's protective of the deployed person. And then if there is another issue to be brought up, they have to hash that out in court then.
Right. That would be part of the evidence at the hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was the address I needed. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you both for being here. Mr. Wolliver, maybe we could hear from you about the Internet and Skype aspects of the bill. We're on page 4, lines 25 to 28. You reviewed the bill for the court system. I know you're frequently loath to be pinned down about how you feel about the bill. Maybe you could tell us if you've thought about the implications of whether the court system is ready to implement them if we pass the law.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Doug Wolliver, administrative attorney for the Alaska court system. We had asked for a clarification from the sponsor on what electronic meant. We can do Skype-type things. If what was intended was full-blown video teleconferencing, that's very expensive. We don't have any courts that currently do that. We have a connection between Anchorage Court and the jail, but that's just a closed-loop connection. The amendment to this section makes it clear that it's the Internet-based, and it isn't ideal, but we just did one in Anchorage week before last on a custody case, and we can project the person who's participating from outside the courtroom's picture on the wall or their testimony on the wall. It's harder for them to see very well, but we can see them very well, and everybody agreed it was well worth doing. So we don't have a we can do this, I think, pretty much everywhere. There may be bandwidth issues in some location or another. I'm not sure. Most of these, I presume, are going to be in Anchorage and Fairbanks, where most of the people are deployed from, and we shouldn't have a problem doing it in those locations.
As I recall, child custody matters are dealt with in Superior Court, not District Court, so it's not as if you'll be in the absolute sort of smallest of villages. You're going to be in the major metropolitan areas such as they are in our state.
That's true, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just you don't see any additional costs from the video conferencing or internet conferencing?
To the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I checked with our tech person on Thursday or Friday of this past week, and it may be a couple hundred dollars to do it in a courtroom. I don't know exactly how much, but in that neighborhood, if we do have a fiscal note, it would be very small.
Just a couple hundred dollars per instance?
I believe so, through the chair.
Do you know how many instances?
I'm sorry, per courtroom or per case?
Per courtroom. Just, okay. And I think it's just essentially to buy the little video. It doesn't cost anything for us to just see them. If they want to see what's going on, then there are a variety of little camera options you can get, some which allow them on the, you know, on the distant end to direct it and look at the courtroom. Maybe you'd want two or three if they didn't have. Anyway, we would look into those types of things.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, if it's that cheap and it's on a per courtroom basis, I guess my suggestion would be let's just do it for everyone. If people are out in the bush, can't get to court, or people are in another state, it's probably not a bad idea to do it in every child custody case.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I think the court's moving in that. We already, of course, as you know, do a lot of telephonic testimony, and as these other technologies come online, we'll be adopting them as well.
Okay. I was looking at that sentence, wondering whether we shouldn't expand it, and we'll hold the bill over at least one, you know, hearing just to ponder questions like that. Senator McGuire, do you have a question?
No.
Okay, very good. Senator, okay. Anything else for Mr. Wolliver or Mr. Temple? Thank you both. We will hold the bill over to the next hearing just to give ourselves a couple of days to internalize it, but it seems like a great piece of work, and congratulations to you and the bill sponsor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Next up is SJR 246, increasing the number of Superior Court judges. Mr. Wolliver, welcome.
Interesting.
Thank you so much. Put yourself on the record, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, Doug Wolliver, administrative attorney for the Alaska court system. This bill adds one Superior Court judge to the 3rd Judicial District. We intend to put it in Anchorage, and we intend for that judge to handle civil cases. Because the statutes determine how many Superior Court judges there are, this is a takes a bill and not just a change in the budget. There are a couple of reasons we want to add a new Superior Court judge in Anchorage. We could probably request three Superior Court judges in Anchorage without any trouble, but we're requesting one, and we hope to make some other kind of procedural reforms so that either we don't have to add the additional judges, or if we do, it won't be this year. There are a couple of case types that have resulted in increase in workload for Superior Court judges. They're not an increase in filings, but there are child need of aid cases, and the cases where one party is unrepresented by counsel or both parties are unrepresented by counsel. The China cases, the judges are spending more time on China cases now than they used to because we're having the standing masters do less work and Superior Court judges do more work. In the old days, a child need of aid case would come to a standing master, would proceed through the master until there was a contested hearing, at which case it would be sent to a Superior Court judge temporarily and then sent back to the master. The trouble with this system would save judge time because they had the master doing most of the work, but it sent families bouncing back and forth between one judge and the master and then another judge and the master. Superior Court judges are the one with the ultimate authority to make decisions in China cases, and sometimes those judges just weren't all that familiar with the cases, and also importantly, the families weren't familiar with the judge that was deciding the case. So our new practice in Anchorage takes more time for a Superior Court judge. The case doesn't take longer, it's just that who's doing the work has changed. Superior Court judges are spending more time on these cases, and that's better for the families. They get to know the judge better. It's better for the outcome of the case, because the judge knows the family. There's another thing that we're doing now in China cases that we haven't done in the past, and that's more status hearings. Right now, the way the process works, a family will be told, you know, you have to get all of this work done if you want your children back. Find a job, get in safe, sober housing, take care of the domestic violence problems, take care of substance abuse problems. There are a lot of things they have to do. Judges found, largely through the therapeutic court process, that regular status hearings before the judge keep families on track. It keeps them focused on what they need to do. It keeps the judge informed about their progress, and it increases the likelihood that the ultimate goal is going to be reunification of the family, because you're going to get the family fixed, at least improved, so that they can get their kids back. So those are two things we're doing differently. So we have the same number of cases, but we've got Superior Court judges spending more time on them. The other case type that's causing more and more work for the same number of cases are the number of cases where people are unrepresented. Christine Pate mentioned in the last hearing that, you know, in some of these cases, 80% are unrepresented. And in family law cases, divorce cases, that's about what it is for all the post-decree motion work. There are very few attorneys involved in these cases as a percentage of the cases that are filed. And even when domestic relations cases are first filed, only about 37% of those cases have a lawyer on both sides. 37% have a lawyer, have no lawyers at all, and about a quarter of them have a lawyer on one side but not the other. These cases require more work for the judges. Everything runs smoothest in a court case if both sides are represented by competent counsel. They know the information that's required. They know to bring it to court on time. They know what the legally relevant issues are, and they know how and when to file motions. Unrepresented litigants aren't as skilled at the process, but the problem for the court is their cases are just as important. A lot of people can't afford attorneys, and our court, like courts around the country, have taken a number of steps to try to make it easier for people who can't afford a lawyer to still access the court system. But that takes more time. We have, by making it easier for them to do this type of thing, particularly with our Family Law Self-Help Center, which helps pro se litigants, we provide a lot of forms for them, but we also make it easy so more people do it. So judges are spending more and more and more time on these cases. Mm-hmm. So one Superior Court judge will help this workload somewhat, but we're also going to be looking at less expensive ways to improve the system. Hiring a new judge with the accompanying staff and things is the most expensive solution. So what we're trying to do is implement some case managers so that pro se cases can proceed more smoothly. They don't have a hearing until they have their information. More help figuring out child support awards, which right now Superior Court judges are spending a lot of time on. It's not Superior Court judge work, but right now they're the only ones who are doing it. So we're going to try to see if we can implement some of these other changes so that we don't have to come back for more judges than we are already asking for. But right now, we'd like one.
Mr. Woolover, thank you. Questions from Mr. Woolover. Senator Coghill.
Thank you. Do the therapeutic courts then fall into that category of time-consuming? It seems to me like they're quite time-consuming, too, or is this done at a whole different level?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, they're a little bit different because the therapeutic court, normally those litigants, if you go through the regular process, they're not time-consuming at all. They're misdemeanants. They come in. They plead not guilty. A little while later, they come back. They plead guilty, and they're gone. It takes very little time. In the therapeutic court process, they're coming back to court multiple times. The end result, the end hope for those is you won't see them as repeat offenders. So once you go through the 18-month program of seeing them a lot and spending a lot of time on them, you won't be spending time on them in the future. A lot of these cases are much different because, as you know, custody cases can be before the court for 18 years. And child need, in terms of the pro se litigants, they'll be back around for, they'll be coming back to court a lot. But in terms of the therapeutic approach with the China cases, there's a very clear end date in China cases, and that's if you don't get your act together, you lose your children. So this doesn't save time in that regard. It doesn't add time to the case because the federal statutes kind of dictate the timeline. But hopefully it makes better decisions and increases the likelihood that they will get their act together and that they will get their kids back.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Don't see any other questions for you, Mr. Woolover. We do have one person signed to testify. We have Tracy Wallenberg on the line to answer questions, but I don't see any. If you have questions for a member of the public defenders, you can direct them to Tracy Wallenberg. We also have Teresa Obermeyer on, who would like to testify. Ms. Obermeyer, can you hear me?
Yes. Am I coming across well, Mr. French?
Yes, you are. Go ahead and put yourself on the record. We'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Now, I don't know how long I have. I've sat here since the meeting began, and so many things have gone through my mind. And I really did. Well, first of all, ladies and gentlemen, I feel like I although I have really not met Senator Egan, I feel like I know all the rest of you somewhat. And it made me very reflective when the military and this other bill was being presented, because it made me think of why I could be in the circumstances that I am in today. And that is that I, ladies and gentlemen, know civil law. It is so very different from military law. Military law is based on command authority. Civil law is based on due process. I've always in my life known due process. I'm a college administrator with a PhD. I wanted to mention that, and I don't mean to get off the topic at hand, which is Senate Bill 246, but then I also really always wanted to mention, because we're sitting here now, Hollis, 26 years later, and can we go on to a subject other than the Alaska Bar Exam? You know, I wanted to mention that, and just if you forgive me for a moment, that in the 50 states of the United States of America, bar exams all over the U.S. are tests of minimal competence. I wanted to be sure to mention that, and truly just to bring up, and I didn't mention, I wasn't even really coming down here today to talk about this, but I saw this, and Liesl, I got my binder, and then I saw this was going on, and I sat here the rest of the afternoon because it really motivates me when I hear that the bill is about creating more judgeships. It's okay. I mean, if that's what you're going to do, it's fine with me. But although I know this, it's all becoming so bureaucratic. And I know that in our state, about 30% of the in-state attorneys work for the government. And I've compared the state of Texas, which has less oil development than Alaska, has only about 10%. So I'm just trying to speak here in ballpark. information. You know, should we have another judgeship? I don't have an answer. I know that I still have the transcript of Terry Korns and the people at the Judicial Council making up my first non-jury federal criminal trial. And I know the Alaska Judicial Council is what it is. I can only speak mention that I don't believe in the bar poll. I don't believe in any of this after what I've experienced. But then, you know, things happen. People get judgeships. You know, there are swearings in and stuff. I don't have an answer. I'm just saying it's all becoming so bureaucratic. And what about a practice of law, ladies and gentlemen? It is time for a practice of law. And there should not be such a bureaucratic maze. But then, you know, I want the kids to be helped. I want, you know, and oh, how else I didn't also mention, I know that like 12 years ago, I went to a CLE where there were like 8 Superior Court judges there, and it was chaired by Eric Sanders, and they went down the row and they asked the judges what percent of their caseload was on various issues. At least almost 80% of them, their caseload is child custody, divorce, and domestic violence. That's the caseload of the Alaska court system. You know, I just can only say that there should be other issues in courts. And I want to make sure I say lastly, and not to, you know, how else I always crack a joke and say, talk cheap. Talk is so cheap it doesn't exist. And I know in my life, I can't go to the Alaska court system because I can't afford to. I mean, you know, we're supposed to have Alaska Legal Services Corporation that's supposed to be for civil litigants. Bob Crystal got to sue me for 2 years for defamation, and I couldn't get any help from the Alaska Legal Services Corporation. I couldn't get any help from anybody. And I, you know, I'm mentioning these things because, you know, 99% of the world just gives up and packs it. I mean, do you see me packing, Alice? I am trying so hard to weather all this. I am trying to persevere. This is really for the sake of my 4 children. You know, it's important in life that we, as older, more mature people, persevere and don't just say, well, that's the way it is. I believe in standing up for something that's fair. I hope I haven't been too far flung in my comments, but and I would always be willing, Senator French, to field questions if anyone had one.
That was about 5 minutes. Just about what I had in mind for your testimony. I don't see any questions. Thanks so much.
Yes, sir, and I just want to make sure I mention.
Just go ahead and wrap up. Go ahead and wrap up, please.
Working down there with you, you see how professional he is, and it's an embarrassment to you that Tom doesn't get licensed. I didn't think he works for a state senator. I'm getting really embarrassed for the Alaska legislature. This is just so beyond anything reasonable now, Senator French and colleagues. But you're very patient with me. I appreciate that. I really don't go a lot anymore because what is the point? I become the focus of everyone's hatred, and I don't want to interfere. But you're very nice. Any other questions, Hollis?
I don't see any. Thank you.
And you're very nice to let me say hi and thank you so kindly and have a good meeting.
Same to you. Have a good day. Anybody else on the line that wants to testify about SB 246? Don't hear or see anybody. I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony like the bill before this one. We will hold it over until a future hearing. And if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we are adjourned.